Once and Forever, The Tales of Kenji Miyazawa, translated by John Bester. This is a selection of tales by Kenji Miyazawa, who lived and wrote in northern Japan during the early 1900s, novels, poems, and children's literature. He taught agriculture, he played the cello, and he was a social activist. He did a lot in less than 40 years of life. And I'm completely charmed by these stories. Sometimes not much happens, but that's okay. Sometimes a person or an animal is mean or dies. But in Miyazawa's world, those moments are somehow woven into the magic. I should explain one thing. Miyazawa loved to have his characters speak in regional dialects, like our Twain or Steinbeck, maybe. John Bester, who made the beautiful translation I'm reading from, did his best to translate Miyazawa's Japanese dialects into something that might have a similar feel to English readers and ears. So if a Japanese deer sounds a little Irish, that's the reason. Let's begin. The First Deer Dance. From a gap in the ragged, gleaming clouds to the west, the red rays of the setting sun slanted down on the mossy plain, and the swaying fronds of pampas grass shone like white fire. I was tired and lay down to sleep. Gradually, the rustling of the breeze began to sound to my ears like human speech, and before long it was telling me the true meaning of the deer dance that the country folk still perform on the hills and on the plain of Kitakami. Long ago, in the days when the area was still covered with tall grass and black forests, Kaju, together with his grandfather and the others, came to live there from somewhere east of the river Kitakami. They settled there, cleared the land, and began growing millet. One day, Kaju fell out of a chestnut tree and hurt his knee a little. At such times, it was the local custom to go to the mountains in the west where there was a hot spring, build a shelter there, and bathe in the spring until one was cured. One fine morning, then, Kaju set out for the spring. With his dumplings, his bean paste, and his pot on his back, he walked slowly, limping slightly as he went, across the open country where the plumes of pampas grass were blowing silver. On he went, over streams and across stony wastes, till the mountain range loomed large and clear, and he could pick out each single tree on the mountains like the pins in a pincushion. By now the sun was far gone in the west and glittered palely just above the tops of a stand of a dozen alder trees. Kaju set the load on his back down in the grass, took out some chestnut and millet dumplings, and began to eat. The pampas grass stretched away from him in tuft after tuft, so many of them that they seemed to ripple in shining white waves all over the plain. As he ate his dumplings, Kaju thought to himself, what a fine sight the trunks of the alders made, rising perfectly straight up out of the high grass. But it had been such a hard walk, he was almost too tired to eat. He was soon full, and in the end, despite himself, he had to leave a piece of dumpling about the size of a chestnut burr. I'll leave it for the deer, he said to himself. Deer, do we come and eat? And he put it down by a small white flower that grew at his feet. Then he shouldered his pack and slowly, quite slowly, set off again. But he had only gone a short way when he realized that he had left his cotton towel at the place where he'd stopped to rest. So he turned back again in a hurry. He could still see the stand of alder trees quite clearly, so to go back was really not much trouble. Yet before he reached the place, he suddenly stopped quite still, sensing, beyond all doubt, that the deer were already there. And there, indeed, they were, at least five or six of them, walking toward something, with their moist noses stretched out far in front of them. Kaju tiptoed over the moss toward them, taking care not to brush against the pompous grass. No mistake about it, the deer had come for the dumpling he had left. "Ha! Deer bent wasting no time," he muttered to himself with a smile, and bending down low, crept slowly in their direction. He peeped out from behind a clump of pampas grass, then drew back in surprise. 6 deer were walking round and round in a ring on the stretch of turf. Hardly daring to breathe, Kaju peered at them from between the pampas stems. The sun had touched the summit of one of the alder trees, and its topmost branches shone with a strange green light, so it looked for all the world like some green living creature standing stock still, gazing down at the deer. Each plume of pampas grass shone separate and silver, and the deer's coats seemed even glossier than usual. Delighted, Kaju gently lowered himself onto one knee and concentrated on watching them. They were moving in a wide circle, and he soon noticed that every one of them seemed intent on something that lay in the center of the ring. He was sure of it because their heads and eyes and ears were all pointing in that direction. What was more, from time to time, one or the other of them would break the circle and stagger a few paces forward, as though drawn toward the center. In the middle of the ring, of course, was the chestnut dumpling that Kaju had left there a while ago. The thing that was bothering the deer so much, though, was not the dumpling, it seemed, but Kaju's white cotton towel, which lay in a curve where it had fallen on the ground. Bending his bad leg gently with one hand, Kaju sat himself neatly on his heels on the moss in order to watch. Gradually, the deer's circling slowed down. Now they moved at a gentle trot, every so often dropping out of the ring and putting one foreleg forward toward the center, as though about to break into a run, then just as soon drawing back again and trotting on once more. Their hooves thudded pleasantly on the dark soil of the plain. Finally, they stopped circling altogether and came and stood in a group between Kaju and the towel. Without warning, Kaju's ears began to ring and his body to shake, a feeling as of grass swaying in the breeze. The same things the deer were feeling was coming to him in waves. And the next moment, though he could scarcely credit his own senses, he could actually hear the deer talking. "Shall I go for to look then?" one was saying. "No, you'll be dangerous. Better watch her a bit longer. Mustn't get caught by no trick like old fox did. There'll be only for a dumpling when all's said and done." "Right, right, only too right." So went the deer's talk. "There may be life." "Aye, there'll be summat like a living critter indeed." In the end, one of them seemed to make up his mind. He straightened his back, left the group, and stepped forward. All the other deer stopped to watch. Inch by inch, he edged toward the towel with his neck stretched out just as far as it would go, and his legs all bunched up beneath him. Then quite suddenly, he shot up in the air and came flying back like an arrow. The other 5 deer scattered in all 4 directions, but the first deer stopped dead when he got back to where he'd started, so they calmed down, and sheepishly returning, gathered in front of him.
"How were there? What do there be, that long white thing?"
"There do have wrinkles all the way down her."
"Then her ain't a living critter. There be a toadstool or something after all. Poisonous too, I don't doubt."
"Nah, there bain't no toadstool. There be a living thing all right."
"Be there now, alive and lots of wrinkles too. There be getting on in years then."
"Aye, that sentry guarding the dumpling be a very elderly sentry."
"Whoa. Blue and white sentry. Ho, ho, Private Blue and White.
Shall I go for a look now?"
"Do we go now? It'll be safe enough."
"It won't bite, will it?"
"No, it'll be safe, I'd say."
So another deer crept forward. The 5 who stayed behind nodded their heads approvingly as they watched. The deer who had gone forward seemed scared to death. Time and time again he bunched his forelegs up and arched his back, ready for flight.
only to stretch them out gingerly and creep on again. At last he reached a spot, only a step away from the towel. He stretched his neck out just as far as it would go and went sniff, sniff at the towel. Then suddenly leapt up in the air and came dashing back. They all gave a start and began to run off, but the second deer stopped dead as soon as he got back, so they took courage and gathered their faces close about his head. How were Er? Why did he run away? But I thought Er were going to bite me. What can Er be now? No telling what be sure is that Er be white and blue in patches like. How do Er smell, eh? Er do smell like willow leaves. Do Er breeze? I didn't rightly notice that. Shall I go now? I do e go now. The third deer cautiously advanced. Just then a slight breeze stirred the towel. He stopped in his tracks in fright, and the others gave a violent start. After a while, though, he seemed to calm down and inched forward again until at last he could stretch the tip of his nose out to the towel. The five deer left behind were nodding at each other knowingly, but just then the deer out front went quite stiff, shot up in the air, and came racing back. What did he run away for? 'Cause I had a strange feeling like, be a breathing? Well, I don't rightly think I heard Er breathing. I don't seem to have no mouth either. Do Er have a head? I couldn't rightly tell about that either. Then shall I go and see this time? The fourth deer set out. He was really just as scared as the rest, but he went all the way up to the towel and ever so boldly pressed his nose right against it. Then he drew back in a hurry and scampered back toward them. Ah, Er be soft. Like mud would Er be. Nah, like the fur on bean pods. Somewhat harder than that. What could Er be, then? Any rate, Er be a living critter. I reckon so after all. Aye, Er be sweaty. I think I'll go and have a look myself. The fifth deer, in turn, crept slowly forward. This one seemed to be something of a joker, for he dangled his nose right over the towel, then gave his head a great jerk as much to say, now this looks very suspicious. The other five deer skipped about with amusement. This encouraged the deer out front, and he gave the towel a great lick. But then he, too, was suddenly seized with fright and came darting back with his mouth open and his tongue lolling out. The others were dreadfully alarmed. Were he bitten, then? Did Er hurt? But he just shivered and shivered. Has Er tongue come loose, then? Still he shivered and shivered. Now, what be up with thee? Come on, speak up. Phew! Me tongue be all numb-like. What kind of taste do Er have? No taste. Would Er be alive? I don't rightly know. Do we go and have a look now? Aye. Slowly, the last deer went forward. The others all watched, nodding their heads with interest as he bent down and sniffed at the thing for a while. Then quite suddenly, he picked it up in his mouth and came back with it as though there was nothing at all to be afraid of any more. The other deer bounced up and down with delight. Well done, well done. Once we got Er bent, nothing to be afeard of. For sure Er just be a big dried-up slug. Come now, I'll sing. Do we all dance around Er? The deer who had said this went into the middle of the group and began to sing, and the rest began to circle round and round the towel. They ran and whirled and danced, and again as they did so, one or the other of them would dash forward and stab the towel with his antlers or trample it with his hooves. In no time, Kaju's poor towel was all muddy and holed. Then gradually the deer's circling slowed down. Ah, now for the dumpling. A boiled dumpling and all. It'll be quite round. Oh, yum yum. Oh, lovely. The deer split up and gathered about the chestnut dumpling. Then they all ate, one mouthful of it in turn, beginning with the deer who had gone up to the towel first. The sixth and last deer got a piece hardly bigger than a bean. Then they formed a ring again and began walking round and round. Kaju had been watching the deer so intently that he almost felt he himself was one of them. He was on the point of rushing out to join them when he caught sight of his own large, clumsy hand. So he gave up the idea and went on trying to keep his breathing quiet. Now the sun had reached the middle branches of the alder tree and was shining with a yellowish light. The deer's dance grew slower and slower. They started nodding to each other busily, then soon drew themselves up in a line facing the sun, standing perfectly straight as though in homage to it. Kaju watched in a dream, forgetful of everything else. All at once, the deer at the right-hand end of the line began to sing in a high, thin voice.
See the setting sun decline, blazing out behind the leaves that delicately shine green upon the alder tree.
Kaju shut his eyes and shivered all over at the sound of the voice, which was like a crystal flute. Then the second deer from the right suddenly leapt up and, twisting his body to and fro, ran in and out between the others, bowing his head again and again to the sun, till at last he returned to his own place, stopped quite still, and began to sing. Now the sun's behind its back. See the leafy alder tree like a mirror crack and shatter in a million lights. Kaju caught his breath and himself bowed low to the sun in its glory and to the alder tree. Now the third deer from the right began to sing, bending and raising his head all the while. Homeward though the sun may go down beyond the alder tree, see the grass aglow, dazzling white across the plain. It was true, the pampas grass was all ablaze like a sea of white fire. Long and black the shadow lies on the shimmering pampas grass, where against the skies straight and tall the alder grows. Now the fifth deer hung his head low and started singing in a voice that was hardly more than a murmur.
See the sun is sinking low in the shimmering pampas grass. Ants now homeward go through the moss upon the plain.
Soon all the deer were hanging their heads. But suddenly the sixth deer raised his head proudly and sang,
Shy white flower, content to pass your quiet days where none can see amidst the autumn grass, of all the loveliest to me.
Then all the deer together gave a short, sharp call like the cry of a flute, leapt up in the air, and began to dash round and round in a ring. A cold wind came whistling from the north. The alder tree sparkled as though it really were a broken mirror. Its leaves actually seemed to tinkle as they brushed against each other, and the plumes of grass seemed to be spinning round with the deer. By now, Kaju had forgotten all about the difference between himself and the deer.
Ho! Bravo! Bravo! He cried and rushed out from his hiding place.
For a moment, the deer stopped stiff and straight in alarm. Then they were fleeing like leaves before a gale. Their bodies bent forward in haste, breasting the waves of silver grass and the shining sunset. They fled far, far into the distance, leaving the pampas grass where they had passed glittering on and on like the wake of a boat on a quiet lake. Kaju smiled a rueful smile. Then he picked up his muddy, torn towel and set off toward the west. And that was all. Until I heard the story from the clear autumn breeze in the late sunlight that day on the mossy plain.
Wildcat and the Acorns. One Saturday evening, a most peculiar postcard arrived at Ichiro's house. This is what it said. Mr. Ichiro Kaneta, pleased to know as how you're well. Tomorrow, I've got a difficult case to judge, so please come. Please don't bring no firearms. Yours respectfully, Wildcat. That was all. The writing was terrible and the ink so blobby it almost stuck to his fingers. But Ichiro was quite delighted. He put the card in his satchel when no one was looking and took it to school, and all day long he was bouncing up and down with joy. Even after he'd crept into bed that night, he still kept imagining Wildcat's face with its cat's grin and the scene at tomorrow's trial and so many other things that he couldn't get to sleep until quite late. When he awoke, though, it was already broad daylight. He went outside, and there were the hills lined up beneath a bright blue sky, rising as fresh and clean as though they'd just been made. He hurried through his breakfast and set off alone up the path by the stream in the valley. There was a fresh morning breeze, and at each puff, the chestnut trees showered their nuts in all directions. Ichiro looked up at them. "Hello there, chestnut trees," he called. "Did Wildcat pass this way?" And the trees paused a while in their rustling and replied, "Wildcat! Yes, he rushed past in a carriage early this morning, going to the east." "The east? That's the direction I'm heading in. How strange! At any rate, I'll keep going this way and see. Thank you, chestnut trees." The chestnut trees made no answer, but went on scattering their nuts around. So Ichiro went a little farther and came to the Flute Falls. About halfway up a pure white cliff, there was a small hole through which the water spurted, whistling like a flute before dropping with a roar into the valley below. Facing the waterfall, Ichiro shouted up at it, "Hello there, Flute Falls! Did Wildcat pass this way?"
"Wildcat!" came a high, whistly voice. "Yes, he rushed past in a carriage a while ago, going to the west."
"The west," said Ichiro. "That's where my home is. How strange. Anyway, I'll go a bit further and see. Thank you, waterfall." But the waterfall was already whistling to itself as it always did. So Ichiro went on a bit and came to a beech tree. Under the tree, a crowd of white mushrooms were playing together in a funny kind of orchestra. Tiddly-dum-dum, tiddly-dum-dum. Ichiro bent down toward them. "Hello, mushrooms," he said. "Did Wildcat pass this way?"
"Wildcat?" replied the mushrooms.
"Yes, he rushed past in a carriage early this morning, going to the south."
"That's strange," said Ichiro, in growing puzzlement. "That's in those mountains over there. Anyway, I'll go a bit farther and see. Thank you, mushrooms." But the mushrooms were already busy again, playing their peculiar music. Tiddly-dum-dum, tiddly-dum-dum. Ichiro was walking on when he noticed a squirrel hopping about in the branches of a walnut tree. "Hey, squirrel," called Ichiro, waving at him to stop. "Did Wildcat pass this way?"
"Wildcat," said the squirrel, shading his eyes with the paw as he peered down at Ichiro.
"Yes, he rushed past this morning in a carriage while it was still dark, going to the south."
"The south," said Ichiro. "That's strange. That's twice I've been told that. Ah, well, I'll go a bit farther and see. Thank you, squirrel." But the squirrel had gone. All he could see was the topmost branches of the walnut tree swaying a little, and the leaves of the neighboring beech tree flashing for a moment in the sun. A little farther on, and the path along the stream grew narrower, then disappeared altogether. There was another narrow path, however, leading up toward the dark wood to the south of the stream. So Ichiro set off up it. The branches of the trees were heavy and so close together that not even the tiniest patch of blue sky was to be seen.
The path became steeper and steeper. Ichiro's face turned bright red, and sweat fell off it in great drops. But then, quite suddenly, he came out into the light. He had reached a beautiful golden meadow. The grass rustled in the breeze, and all around stood fine olive-colored trees. There, in the middle of the meadow, a most odd-looking little man was watching Ichiro. His back was bent, and in his hand he held a leather whip. Ichiro went slowly nearer, then stopped in astonishment. The little man was one-eyed, and his blind eye, which was white, was moving nervously all the time. His legs were very bandy, like a goat's, and most peculiar of all, his feet were shaped like spades. "You wouldn't happen to know Wildcat, would you?" Ichiro asked, trying not to show his nervousness. The little man looked at Ichiro with his one eye, and his mouth twisted in a leer.
"Mr. Wildcat will be back in just a moment," he said. "You'll be Ichiro, I suppose?"
Ichiro started back in astonishment.
"Yes, I'm Ichiro," he replied. "But how did you know?"
The strange little man gave an even broader leer.
"Then you got the postcard?" he asked.
"Yes, that's why I came."
"Badly written, wasn't it?"
asked the little man, looking gloomily down at the ground. Ichiro felt sorry for him.
"No," he said, "it seemed very good to me." The man gave a little gasp of joy and blushed to the tips of his ears. He pulled his coat open at the neck to cool himself and asked, "Is the handwriting all right?"
Ichiro couldn't help smiling.
"It was fine," he said.
"I doubt if even a fifth grader could write that well." The little man suddenly looked depressed again.
"When you say fifth grader, you mean at primary school, I suppose?"
His voice was so listless and pathetic that Ichiro was alarmed.
"Oh, no," he said hastily,
"at university." The little man cheered up again and grinned so broadly that his face seemed to be all mouth.
"I wrote that postcard," he shouted.
"Just who are you then?" asked Ichiro, trying not to smile.
"I am Mr. Wildcat's coachman," he replied.
A sudden gust of wind rippled over the grass, and the coachman gave a deep bow. Puzzled, Ichiro turned around, and there was Wildcat standing behind him. He wore a fine coat of yellow brocade, and his green eyes, as he stared at Ichiro, were perfectly round. Ichiro barely had time to note that his ears were pointed and stuck up, just like an ordinary cat's, before Wildcat gave a stiff little bow.
"Oh, good morning," said Ichiro politely, bowing in return.
"Thank you for the postcard."
"Good morning," said Wildcat,
pulling his whiskers out stiff and sticking out his chest.
"I'm pleased to see you. The fact is, a most troublesome dispute arose the day before yesterday, and I don't quite know how to settle it, so I thought I might ask your opinion. But anyway, make yourself at home, won't you? The acorns should be here any moment now. Really, you know, I have a lot of trouble with this trial every year." He took a cigarette case from inside his coat and put a cigarette in his mouth.
"Won't you have one?" he asked, offering the case to Ichiro.
"Oh, no, thank you," said Ichiro, startled. "Oh, of course, you're still too young," said Wildcat with a lordly kind of laugh. He struck a match and, screwing up his face self-consciously, puffed out a cloud of blue smoke.
His coachman, who was stiffly standing by awaiting orders, seemed to be dying for a cigarette himself, as there were big tears rolling down his face. Just then, Ichiro heard a tiny crackling sound at his feet, like salt being tossed on a fire. He bent down in surprise to look and saw that the ground was covered with little round gold things glinting in the grass. He looked closer and found that they were acorns. There must have been over 300 of them, all wearing red trousers and all chattering away about something at the top of their voices.
"Here they come, just like a lot of ants," said Wildcat, throwing away his cigarette.
Hurriedly, he gave orders to the coachman. "You there, ring the bell," he said,
and cut the grass just here where it's sunny." The coachman took up a big sickle at his side and swished down the grass in front of Wildcat. Immediately, the acorns came rushing out from the surrounding grass, glittering in the sun as they came, and chattering like mad. The coachman rang his bell. Clang, clang, it went. Clang, clang. The sound echoed through the woods, and the golden acorns became a little quieter. Unnoticed by Ichiro, Wildcat had put on a long black satin gown and was now sitting there in front of them, looking important. It reminded Ichiro pictures he had seen of crowds of tiny worshippers before a great bronze idol.
Swish, crack,
went the coachman with his whip. The sky was blue and cloudless, and the acorns sparkled beautifully. "Let me remind you, this is the third day this case has been going on," Wildcat began. "Now, why don't you call it off and make it up with each other?" His voice was a little nervous, but he forced himself to sound important. No sooner had he spoken, though, than the acorns set up a commotion again.
"No, that's impossible. Whatever you say, the one with the most pointed head is best. And it's me who's the most pointed." "No, you're wrong. The roundest one's best. I'm the roundest." "It's size, I tell you. I'm the biggest, so I'm the best." "That's nonsense. I'm much bigger. Don't you remember the judge said so yesterday?" "You're all wrong. It's the one who's the tallest one, I tell you." "No, it's the one who's best at pushing and shoving. That's what settles it."
The acorns were making such a racket that in the end you had absolutely no idea what it was all about. It was like stirring up a hornet's nest.
"That's enough," Wildcat bawled. "Where do you think you are? Silence! Silence!" Swish, crack, went the coachman's whip, and at last the acorns were quiet.
"Let me remind you again, this is the third day this trial has been going on," Wildcat declared, twisting his whiskers till they stood on end. "How about calling it off now and making things up?"
"No, no, it's no good. Whatever you say, the one with the most pointed head's best." "No, you're wrong. The roundest one's best." "No, he's not. It's the biggest." Chatter, chatter, chatter again till you had no idea what was going on. "That's enough. Where do you think you are?" Wildcat shouted. "Silence! Silence!" Swish, crack, went the coachman's whip again.
Wildcat twisted his whiskers till they stood straight up, then started again. "I don't need to remind you, this is the third day this case has been going on. Why don't you call it off and be friends again?"
"No, no, it's no good. The one with the most pointed head..."
Chatter, chatter, chatter.
"That's enough," Wildcat yelled. "Where do you think you are? Silence, silence!"
Again the coachman's whip went swish, crack. And again the acorns fell silent. "You see what it's like," whispered Wildcat to Ichiro. "What do you think I ought to do?" Ichiro smiled. "Well, here's one suggestion," he said. "Tell them that the best is the one who's most stupid, most ridiculous, and most good for nothing. I heard that in a sermon, actually." Wildcat nodded wisely and prepared to give his verdict, pulling open his satin gown at the neck so that the yellow brocade coat showed a little. He put on his grandest air. Then he spoke.
"Right. Be quiet now.
Here is my verdict. The best of you is the one who is least important, most foolish, most ridiculous, absolutely good for nothing, and completely crack-brained.
A hush fell over the acorns, such a complete hush that you could have heard a pin drop. Wildcat took off his black gown, and wiping the sweat from his forehead, shook Ichiro's hand while the coachman cracked his whip 5 or 6 times for sheer joy.
"I'm most obliged to you," said Wildcat to Ichiro. "I must say you've taken a most awkward case off my hands in not so much as a minute and a half. I do hope you'll act as an honorary judge in my court again in the future. If ever I send you a postcard from now on, please come, won't you? I'll see you're suitably rewarded every time."
"Of course I'll come," said Ichiro, "but I don't want any reward."
"Oh, no," objected Wildcat, "you must accept one. It's a matter of honor for me, you see, and from now on, I'll address the postcard to Ichiro Kaneta Esquire, and call this the court. Is that all right?"
"That's fine," said Ichiro. Wildcat was silent for a moment, twirling his whiskers as though there was something more he wanted to say. Then he seemed to take courage and went on.
"About the wording of the card. How would it be if I put it like this? Pertaining to certain business in hand, your presence in court is formally requested."
Ichiro smiled. "It sounds rather funny to me, somehow. Perhaps you'd better leave that bit out." Wildcat gazed crestfallen at the ground, still twiddling his whiskers as though regretting that he hadn't put it better. Finally, with a sigh, he said,
"Well then, we'll leave it as it stands."
"Oh yes, about your reward for today. Which would you prefer, a pint of gold acorns or a salted salmon head?"
"The acorns, please," replied Ichiro.
Wildcat turned straight to his coachman, as if relieved that it hadn't been the salmon head. "Get a pint of gold acorns," he said, speaking fast, "and if there aren't enough, you can put in some gold-plated ones, and be quick about it." The coachman began to scoop the acorns into a square wooden measure. When he had finished, he shouted,
"One pint exactly!"
Wildcat's brocade coat flapped in the breeze. He stretched, closed his eyes, and smothered a yawn.
"Right," he said. "Now hurry up and get the coach ready."
A carriage made of a great white mushroom appeared, drawn by a horse of a most peculiar shape and gray in color, just like a rat, in fact. Wildcat turned to Ichiro.
"And now we'll see you home," he said.
They got into the carriage. The coachman put the measure full of acorns in beside them, and swish, crack, off they went. The meadow was left behind, and trees and bushes swayed by in a bluish haze. Ichiro's eyes were fixed on his gold acorns, while Wildcat was gazing quite innocently into the distance. But as the carriage journeyed on, the acorns lost their glitter, and when, in no time it seemed, the carriage came to a halt, they were just the plain, ordinary brown kind. Wildcat's yellow brocade coat and the coachman and the mushroom carriage all had vanished together, and Ichiro was left standing in front of his own home, the measure of acorns in his hand. From that time on, there were no more postcards signed, "Yours respectfully, Wildcat." Ichiro sometimes wonders about it. Perhaps he ought to have let Wildcat write, "Your presence is formally requested," after all.
The Bears of Nametoko. It's interesting, that business of the bears on Mount Nametoko. Nametoko is a large mountain, and the Fujisawa River starts somewhere inside it. On most days of the year, The mountain breeze in and breeze out, cold mists and clouds. The peaks all around it, too, are like blackish green sea slugs or bald sea goblins. Halfway up it, there yawns a great cave from which the river Fujizawa abruptly drops some 300 feet in a waterfall that goes thundering down through the thick-growing cypresses and maples. Nowadays, nobody uses the old highway, so it is all grown over with butterbur and knotweed, and there are places where people have put up fences on the track to stop cattle from straying and climbing up the slopes. But if you push your way for about 6 miles through the rustling undergrowth, you will hear in the distance a sound like the wind on a mountaintop. If you peer carefully in that direction, you might be puzzled to see something long, white, and narrow trailing down the mountain in a flurry of mist. This is the Ozora Falls, and in that area, they say, there used to be any number of bears.
Now, I must confess that I have never actually seen either Mount Nemetoko or the liver of a newly killed bear. All this is based on what I've heard from other people or worked out for myself. It may not be entirely true, though I, for one, believe it. But I do know that Mount Nemetoko is famous for its bear's liver, which is good for stomach aches and helps wounds heal. At the entrance to the Namari Hot Spring, there is a sign that says, "Bear's liver from Mount Nemetoko." So there are definitely bears on the mountain. I can almost see them going across the valleys with their pink tongues lolling out, and the bear cubs wrestling with each other till finally they lose their temper and box each other's ears. It was bears like these that the famous hunter Kojiro Fujizawa once killed so freely. Kojiro was a swarthy, well-knit, middle-aged man with a squint. His body was massive like a barrel, and his hands were as big and thick as the handprint of the god Bishamon that they used to cure people's illnesses at the Kitajima Shrine. In summer, he wore a cape made of bark to keep off the rain, with leggings, and he carried a woodsman's axe and a gun as big and heavy as an old-fashioned blunderbuss. With his great yellow hound for company, he would tramp across the mountains from Mount Nemetoko to Shidoke Valley, from Mitsumata to Mount Sakai, from Mamiana Wood to Shira Valley. When he went up the old, dried-up valleys, the trees grew so thickly that it was like going through a shadowy green tunnel, though sometimes it suddenly became bright with green and gold, and at other times, sunlight fell all around as though the whole place had burst into bloom. Kojiro moved at a slow and ponderous pace, as completely at home as though he were in his own living room. The hound ran on ahead, scampering along high banks or plunging into the water. He would swim for all he was worth across the sluggish, faintly sinister backwaters, then, when he finally reached the other side, would shake himself vigorously to dry his coat, and stand with wrinkled nose waiting for his master to catch up. Kojiro would come across with his mouth slightly twisted, moving his legs stiffly and cautiously like a pair of compasses, while the water splashed up in a white curl above his knees. The bears in the area of Mount Nemetoko were fond of Kojiro. One proof of this is that they would often gaze down in silence from some high place as he squelched his way up the valleys or passed along the narrow ledges, overgrown with thistles, that bordered the valley. Clinging to a branch at the top of a tree, or sitting on a bank with their paws around their knees, they would watch with interest as he went by. The bears even seemed to like Kojiro's hound. Yet for all that, they didn't like it much when they really came up against him and the dog flew at them like a ball of fire, or when Kojiro, with a strange glint in his eyes, leveled his gun at them. At such times, most of them would wave their paws as though in distress, telling him that they didn't want to be treated in that way. But there are all kinds of bears, just as there are all kinds of people, and the fiercest of them would rear up on their hind legs with a great roar and advance on Kojiro with both paws stretched out, ignoring the dog as though they could crush him underfoot as easily as that. Kojiro would remain perfectly calm, and taking aim at the center of the bear's forehead from behind a tree, would let fly with his gun. The whole forest would seem to cry out loud, and the bear would slump to the ground. Dark red blood would gush from his mouth, and he would snuffle rapidly, and he would die. Then Kojiro would stand his gun against a tree, cautiously go up to the bear, and say something like this. "Don't think I killed you, bear, because I hated you. I have to make a living, just as you have to be shot. I'd like to do different work, work with no sin attached, but I've got no fields, and they say my trees belong to the authorities, and when I go into the village, nobody will have anything to do with me. I'm a hunter because I can't help it. It's fate that made you a bear, and it's fate that makes me do this work. Make sure you're not reborn as a bear next time." At times like this, the dog, too, would sit by him with narrowed eyes and a dejected air. The dog, you see, was Kojiro's sole companion. In the summer of his 40th year, his whole family had fallen sick with dysentery, and his son's wife had died. The dog, however, had remained healthy and active. Next, Kojiro would take out of his pocket a short, razor-sharp knife, and in one long stroke slit the bear's skin open from under his chin down to his chest and onto his belly. The scene that followed I don't care to think about. Either way, in the end, Kojiro would put the bright red bear's liver in the wooden chest on his back, wash the fur, which was all in dripping bloody tassels in the river, roll it up, put it on his back, and set off down the valley with a heavy heart. It even seemed to Kojiro that he could understand what the bears were saying to each other. Early one spring, before any of the trees had turned green, Kojiro took the dog with him and went far up the marshy bed of Shira Valley. As dusk drew near, he began to climb up the pass leading over to Bakai Valley, where he had built a small hut of bamboo grass to shelter in. But for some reason or other, Kojiro, unusually for him, took the wrong trail. Any number of times he started up, then came down and started up again. Even the dog was quite exhausted, and Kojiro himself was breathing heavily out of one side of his mouth before they finally found the hut he'd built the year before, which was half tumbled down. Remembering that there had been a spring just below the hut, Kojiro set off down the mountain, but had only gone a little way when, to his surprise, he came across two bears, a mother and a cub barely a year old, standing in the faint light of the still new moon, staring intently at the far-off valley with their paws up to their foreheads, just as human beings do when gazing into the distance. To Kojiro, the bears looked as if they were surrounded by a kind of halo, and he stopped and stared at them, transfixed. Then the small bear said in a wheedling voice, "I'm sure it's snow, Mother. Only the near side of the valley is white, isn't it? Yes, I'm sure it's snow." The mother bear went on staring for a while before saying, "It's not snow. It wouldn't fall in just that one place." "Then it must have been left there after the rest melted," said the cub. "No, I went there only yesterday on my way to look for thistle buds." Kojiro stared hard in the same direction. The moonlight was gliding down the mountainside, which gleamed like silver armor. After a while, the cub spoke again. "If it's not snow, then it must be frost. I'm sure it is." There really will be a frost tonight, thought Kojiro to himself. A star was shimmering blue close to the moon. Even the color of the moon itself was just like ice. "I know what it is," said the mother bear. "It's cherry blossom."
"Is that all? Even I've seen that."
"No, you haven't, dear."
"But I have. I went and brought some home myself the other day."
"No, that wasn't cherry. It was some kind of beech, I think."
"Really?" the cub said innocently. For some reason, Kojiro's heart felt full. He gave a last glance at the snowy flowers over in the valley, at the mother bear and her cub standing bathed in the moonlight. Then stealthily, taking care to make no sound, withdrew. As he crept away, praying all the while that the wind wouldn't blow his scent in their direction, the fragrance of spice bush came sharply to him in the moonlight. When he went to town to sell the bear skins and the bear liver, that same brave Kojiro cut a much humbler figure. Somewhere near the center of the town, there was a large hardware store where winnowing baskets and sugar, whetstones and cheap cigarettes, and even glass fly traps were set out for sale. Kojiro had only to step over the threshold of the shop with a great bundle of bearskins on his back for the people there to start smiling as though to say, "Here he is again." The owner of the place would be seated massively beside a large brazier in a room leading off the shop. "Thank you for your kindness last time, sir," Kojiro would say. And the hunter who back in the hills was completely his own master would lay down his bundle of skins and, kneeling on the boards, bow low. "Well, well, well, and what can I do for you today?" "I brought along a few bearskins again." "Bearskins? The last ones are still lying around here somewhere. We don't need any more." "Come on, sir. Give us a chance. I'll let you have them cheap." "I don't care how cheap they are. I don't want them," the shopkeeper would tell him calmly, tapping out the small bowl of his pipe against the palm of his hand. Whenever he heard this, Kojiro, brave lord of the hills, would feel his face twist with anxiety. Where Kojiro came from, there were chestnuts to be found in the hills, and millet grew in the apology for a field that lay at the back of the house. But no rice would grow, nor was there any soybean paste for making soup. So he had to have some rice, however little, to take back to the family of seven, his old mother and his grandchildren. If he had lived down in the village, he would have grown hemp for weaving cloth. But at Kojiro's place there were only a few wisteria vines, which were woven into baskets and the like. After a while, Kojiro would say, in a voice hoarse with distress, "Please, please buy some, whatever the price." And he'd bow down low again. The shopkeeper would puff smoke for a while, without saying anything. Then, suppressing a slight grin of satisfaction, would seat himself in front of Kojiro and hand him four large silver coins. Kojiro would accept them with a smile and raise them respectfully to his forehead. Then the owner of the shop would gradually unbend. "Here, give Kojiro some sake." By now, Kojiro would be glowing with delight. The shopkeeper would talk to him at leisure about this and that. Deferentially, Kojiro would tell him of things back in the hills, and soon word would come from the kitchen that the meal was ready. Kojiro would rise to go, but in the end would be dragged off to the kitchen where he would go through his polite greetings once again. Almost immediately, they would bring a small black lacquered table bearing slices of salted salmon with chopped cuttlefish and a flask of warm sake. Kojiro would seat himself very correctly at the table, then start to eat, balancing the pieces of cuttlefish on the back of his hand before gulping them down and reverently pouring the yellowish sake into the tiny cup. However low prices might be, anyone would have agreed that 2 yen was too little for a pair of bearskins. It really was too little, and Kojiro knew it. Why, then, didn't he sell his skins to someone other than that hardware dealer? To most people, it would be a mystery. But in those days, there was an order to things. It was a matter of course that Kojiro should get the better of the bears, that the shopkeeper should get the better of Kojiro, and that the bears, but since the shopkeeper lived in the town, the bears couldn't get the better of him, for the moment at least. Such being the state of affairs, Kojiro killed the bears without feeling any hatred for them. One year, though, a strange thing happened. Kojiro was squelching his way up the valley and had climbed onto a rock to look about him when he saw a large bear, his back hunched, clamoring like a cat up a tree directly in front of him. Immediately, Kojiro leveled his gun. The dog, delighted, was already at the foot of the tree, rushing madly round and round it. But the bear, who for a while seemed to be debating whether he should come down and attack Kojiro or let himself be shot where he was, suddenly let go with his paws and came crashing to the ground. Instantly on his guard, Kojiro tucked his gun into his shoulder and closed in. But at this point, the bear put up his paws and shouted, "What are you after? Why do you have to shoot me?" "For nothing but your fur and your liver," Kojiro replied. "Not that I'll get anything much for them when I take them to town. I'm sorry for you, but it just can't be helped. Though when I hear you say that kind of thing, I feel I'd almost rather live on chestnuts and ferns and the like, even if it killed me." "Can't you wait just 2 more years? For myself, I don't care whether I die or not, but there are still things I've got to do. When 2 years are up, you'll find me dead in front of your house, I promise. You can have my fur and my insides too." Filled with strange emotion, Kojiro stood quite still, thinking. The bear set his 4 paws firmly on the ground and began, ever so slowly, to move away. But Kojiro went on standing there, staring vacantly in front of him. Slowly, slowly the bear walked away without looking back, as though he knew very well that Kojiro would never shoot him from behind. For a moment, his broad brownish-black back shone bright in the sunlight falling through the branches of the trees. And at the same moment, Kojiro gave a painful groan, then headed home across the valley. It was just 2 years later. One morning, the wind blew so fiercely that Kojiro, sure that it was blowing down trees and hedge and all, went outside to look. The cypress hedge was standing untouched, but at its foot lay something brownish-black that seemed familiar. His heart gave a turn, for it was exactly 2 years since that day, and he had been feeling worried in case the bear should come along. He went up to it and found the self-same bear lying there as he had promised, dead, in a great pool of blood that had gushed from his mouth. Almost without thinking, Kojiro pressed his hands together in prayer. It was one day in January. As Kojiro was leaving home that morning, he said something he had never said before. "Mother, I must be getting old. This morning, for the first time in my life, I don't feel I want to wade through all those streams." Kojiro's mother of 90, who sat spinning on the veranda in the sun, raised her rheumy eyes and glanced at him with an expression that might have been either tearful or smiling. Kojiro tied on his straw sandals, heaved himself to his feet, and set off. One after the other, the children poked their faces out of the barn and, smiling, said, "Come home soon, Grandpa." Kojiro looked up at the smooth, bright blue sky, then turned to his grandchildren and said, "I'll be back later." He climbed up through the pure white, close-packed snow in the direction of Shira Valley. The dog was already panting heavily, his pink tongue lolling as he ran ahead and stopped again. Soon Kojiro's figure sank out of sight beyond a low hill, and the children returned to their games. Kojiro followed the bank of the river up the Shira Valley. Here the water lay in deep blue pools where it was frozen into sheets of glass. Here the icicles hung in countless numbers like bead curtains, and on both banks the berries of the spindle tree peeped out like red and yellow flowers. As he climbed upstream, Kojiro saw his own glittering shadow and the dog's, deep indigo and sharply etched on the snow, mingling as they moved with the shadows of the birch trunks. On the other side of the mountain from Shira Valley there lived, as he had confirmed during the summer, a large bear. On he went upstream, fording 5 small tributaries that came flowing into the valley, crossing the water again and again from right to left and from left to right. He came to a small waterfall, from the foot of which he began to climb up toward the ridge. The snow was so dazzling it seemed to be on fire, and as he toiled upward, Kojiro felt as if he saw everything through purple glasses. The dog was climbing as though determined that the steepness of the slope would not beat him, clinging grimly to the snow, though he nearly slipped many times. When they finally reached the top, they found themselves on a plateau that sloped gently away, where the snow sparkled like white marble, and the snow-covered peaks thrust up into the sky, all about them. It happened as Kojiro was taking a rest there at the summit. Suddenly the dog began to bark frantically. Startled, Kojiro looked behind him and saw the same great bear that he had glimpsed that summer, rearing up on his hind legs and lumbering toward him. Without panicking, Kojiro planted his feet firmly in the snow and took aim. Raising his two massive front paws, the bear charged straight at him. Even Kojiro turned a bit pale at the sight. Kojiro heard the crack of the gun, yet the bear showed no sign of falling, but seemed to come swaying on toward him, black and raging like a storm. The dog sank his teeth into his leg. The next moment, a great noise filled Kojiro's head and everything around him went white. Then far off in the distance, he heard a voice saying, "Ah, Kojiro, I didn't mean to kill you." "This is death," he thought. All about him he could see lights twinkling incessantly like blue stars. "Those are the signs that I'm finished," he thought. "The fires you see when you die. Forgive me, bears." As for what he felt from then on, I have no idea. It was the evening of the third day after that. A moon hung in the sky, like a great ball of ice. The snow was a bright bluish white, and the water gave off a phosphorescent glow. The Pleiades and Orion's belt glimmered now green, now orange, as if they were breathing. On the plateau on top of the mountain, surrounded by chestnut trees and snowy peaks, many great black shapes were gathered in a ring, each casting its own black shadow, each prostrate in the snow, like a Muslim at prayer, never moving. And there, at the highest point one might have seen by the light of the snow and the moon, Kojiro's corpse set in a kneeling position. One might even have imagined that on Kojiro's dead, frozen face one could see a chill smile, as though he were still alive. Orion's belt moved to the center of the heavens, then tilted still further to the west, yet the great black shapes stayed quite still, as though they had turned to stone.